Blog Talk Radio.
This is JJ Bomber. You are listening to Well Armed Radio.
Good evening, sheepdogs. Welcome to Well Armed Radio, where freedom is our best friend. Thank you for joining us in our weekly vigorous, relentless, and typically ruthless pursuit of freedom. We are broadcasting live from the very well-armed studio in New Berlin, Wisconsin. It's always my pleasure to speak with the most informed gun owners in the state. That would be you guys. You are your community's finest. And with a face for radio and a voice for silent movies, my name is Nick Clark. I'm the president of Wisconsin Carry and the host of Well Armed Radio. And also the proud, confident, happy to declare that I'm the smartest guy in this room, also the only guy in this room, but encourage you to be a part of the show with your calls, ideas, questions, comments, criticism. Phone number here is 563-999-3787, 563-999-3787. Start the show with the usual warning, no sacred cows here, and as always, excuse me, which is a difficult, a tall ask with most of my listeners being podcast, but the first 50 minutes of the show is open line, so anything you want to call to discuss right away in the show is a chance to do that. Otherwise, the remainder of the show, certainly welcome your calls, but prefer if you keep it on topic to whatever we're talking about at that given moment. So spring is here. Now I've got, I have to say my shout outs. Got a couple people here. Ralph is in the chat tonight. Ralph from Pleasant Prairie, who I'm just guessing is probably still down in Florida. Is that true, Ralph? Or are you back in the frozen tundra up here? Although it's not so much the frozen tundra anymore. That was a couple weeks back and now we got spring. And we've also got, Tommy Lager, if I'm saying that right, in the chat. So great to have both you guys with us tonight. But this is I can't say it's my favorite time of year. My favorite time of year is the fall, but this is the most. What's the word I'm looking for? The most. Oh, we got Lon jumping in tonight too. Ralph's back in Wisconsin. He says burr. So that's the problem, Ralph. You spend so much time down there in Florida, your blood gets all thin, and then you come back up here. And, you know, it's funny because I was at the driving range today, Moreland Driving Range in New Berlin, south there, South Moreland Road. And the funny thing was it was 40, 31, 39, 40. I mean, it wasn't hot. I mean, it wasn't, you know, for us this time of year, you know, upper 50s and sun or 60s, that's hot. But it was, I mean, I think it was, you know, low 40s at best. And the outdoor, you've got at Moreland Driving Range, you've got the indoor heated bays, which have their little, I don't know, they must be natural gas heat. I'm assuming they're natural gas heaters that are above the heating bay. So they're somewhat heated. I mean, it's not really heated because you got the whole open, front of the driving range thing, but it's like it's got basically like a wall, you know, roof, back wall, side walls. And so it's, you know, open on one side. And, but so those are heated. They're somewhat warm ish. And again, the wind, depending on the direction blows in, and it's not all that warm at all, but the outdoor hitting bays, if you want to call them that, that are just out there. I mean, no protection from the wind from that, those were full. And I'm like, and you know, you're in Wisconsin in the spring when it's 40 again, maybe 41, maybe four. It was low 40s or upper 30s. And there's people hitting outside at the driving range. So that was kind of crazy. But yeah, I thought to myself that only in Wisconsin, because, you know, any place else would look at us like we're crazy. So anyway, other than that, like I said, it's my favorite time of year. But let me rephrase. It's not my favorite season, but it's a very optimistic time of year. You know, summer's coming. You know, you've got like 3/4 of the year of decent weather. And I say decent weather, and that's in air quotes, because I think a lot of people live in Wisconsin wouldn't call our weather decent most of the time. But the only weather that I don't like is that below zero crap. I mean, that I have no use for that. I don't think anybody does. But the below zero stuff, I can't stomach it. But 20s, easy breezy, plenty to do here in Wisconsin, at least for us, our activities. You know, we hike with the dog every Saturday during the winter. That's really my only free time is Saturday afternoon. So, yeah, it's always something to do. And then spring, summer, fall, on the yacht, boating. The only thing that ruins my day is a washout is a washout Saturday. That ruins my day, but anything else is manageable here. So yeah, so it's just that very optimistic time of year where, you know, you've got 3/4 of the year ahead of you of again, air quotes, decent weather, with the exception of the inclement stuff that comes running through. So yeah, kind of an exciting time of year, and maybe a little bit more exciting this year, because last year, and the thing is, you didn't know what you were in for. You know, last year, right about this time, Corona-noia was just kicking in. But you didn't know. I kept thinking that people were going to come to their senses. I mean, because I saw this thing for what it was at the beginning. I said, look, this is going to be like a bad flu season at best, this whole Corona thing. And the one thing that I was confident in is was nothing justified the lockdowns, whatever. I saw something today on, it was a news brief or something, and they said the lockdowns didn't crush the coronavirus, they crushed the economy. And that's so true. but the other thing is, just like typical government, they never people are there's such a such a reluctance, such a resistance to people to admit a mistake. And that's a sign. I mean, in business, I mean, the smartest people are the ones that admit mistakes. The smartest people are the ones that fail, learn from it, and do better the next time. It's not people that don't make mistakes. But the easiest thing to do, especially in business, if you make a mistake, you have to admit it. I mean, apologize and boom, get on with it. Not apologizing and not admitting a mistake. I'm watching, this is kind of tangential, but I'm watching, it happened to be on, I turned on the TV today, and Wisconsin was playing Iowa in a basketball game. And there's not a lot of sporting events that I watch. Like the Super Bowl, I'll turn it on. Golf, I like to watch golf. The Masters, love that. But I don't sit there. I just don't have time. I don't sit there and watch TV. I just never sit down and watch. But I just had a couple minutes today. I was like, you know what, I'm just going to sit down. So I sat down for probably, there was like 3 minutes left in the game. I'm like, I'm just going to watch a basketball game here. And at the end of the Wisconsin game, now I guess there's, I didn't know this, but there's instant replay in college. So there's a college game, college basketball game on. They're doing this instant replay thing. And there was one quote foul on the, and this doesn't matter because it's not, my point isn't what happened in the game, but it's just, my point is going to be here that this reluctance to acknowledge error seems to be pervasive in our society today. So I'm watching this Wisconsin basketball game and the referees call a foul. Now, I don't know. I don't follow sports enough at all to know. I mean, but I do find the final, I do find the March Madness interesting. Again, don't sit down and watch it. I don't fill out a bracket. I don't do any of that shit. But I just think it's interesting. College basketball is still a little bit pure. You know, pro sports is completely ruined, completely taken over by the commercialization and the political correctness. And don't get me wrong, there's plenty of that stuff. But Iowa's jerseys said equality on them. I'm like, what the? It's just madness. This whole woke culture and political correct and I mean it's nauseating. And for Iowa, I mean it's not like Stanford or something. Iowa, they've got equality on every jersey. So anyway, there's a foul call. So I don't watch sports enough to know, but I find out that there's replay in college sports. Then I'm like, okay, what do they, they first were replaying an out of bounds play. Then they were replaying. Then they were looking at a foul to see what kind of a foul it was. Was it a flagrant foul? Was it not a flagrant foul? And I'm like, okay, if you can do instant replay to assess a foul, but late in the game, there was a foul called against a shooter. I think his name was Bannon? No, I don't think it's... Anyway, some of it starts with a B. Some, he was kind of the standout for Iowa. Goes to shoot a three, misses it, and they call a foul. Well, then they do the replay on the TV, the network replay, and you can see that it wasn't a foul. Now he gets fouled on a three, makes... The game was touch and go right at that point. It was one team's down two, tied, down two, up two, down two. I mean... up one. It was just back and forth. And then that was the play that just changed the tide of the game. And again, this is like with the minute and a half, minute 45 left or something like that. And it really did change the tide of the game because now you're down three. It used to be when you're down one or two, then every basket, whether it's a 3-point or whatever, you're back in that trade-off mode. But this one, so it really made a difference. Now, but the commentators were very muted in saying they weren't really, you know, they kind of made reference to the fact that it wasn't a good call, that it was what maybe they called it a little ticky tack or something like that. But it just, it was then a few minutes later, they're reviewing these other fouls and it's, and they're like, you know, but they didn't come out and just say, hey, that was a bad call and it affected the game. I mean, it really turned the tide of the game. So there's just this reluctance to acknowledge the reality of what was clearly a mistake. It was clearly a bad call. And again, they kind of allude to it, but, and I know why, because in the NFL, like if you criticize the refs, they get fined. I'm sure the NCAA doesn't want their network. Look, those network broadcasters, they're not like some independent third party watching the action. They're, you know, they're paid by the networks, but the networks have contracts with, the leagues and they can, I'm sure these guys get in trouble if they say something that the league doesn't appreciate. So the league isn't going to appreciate the, the color commentary guys, the announcers for the game, criticizing the refereeing. So it's just this reluctance, but it's like, hey, look, I mean, I think they should just acknowledge, look, it's sports, bad calls are made, but you still can't be afraid to call something a bad call. And I feel like it's the same thing with government. Look, they're going to make mistakes, but they never acknowledge them. It's like this this refusal to acknowledge error. And it's you see it in media, and you see it in, and it's a sign of ignorance to not acknowledge error. So last year at this time, we're starting to get into lockdowns and crap. First, it was just stuff getting canceled. The NCAAs were canceled, and it was just the NBA, I think, started canceling games. And it, I kept thinking, look, people are going to come to their senses. And then they were going to do this. They said, oh, we're going to 2 weeks to slow the spread, 2 weeks to flatten the curve, which I thought was absolute bullshit, because I had always suggested that this coronavirus has been here much, much longer. I mean, it was here much longer than, much earlier than was previously known. There was, if you did any amount of reading, you would know this. If you only got your news from CNN, MSNBC, so on and so forth, you wouldn't. But any amount of reading said, look, there was people that in Florida back in late 2019 who had something, and they later tested positive for the coronavirus antibodies. There was people in California. California has a big number of people coming in from China. And there was I had friends that worked for an automotive company, Stratec here in Milwaukee. And they go to a big auto show, and I forget what it's called, but it's a big auto show out in Vegas. And they were there, I think it was late October of 2019. And so they go to this auto show, and they all came back super sick with the flu-like symptoms. And this auto show, there's a ton of people from China that go to that show, their counterparts, because they have Chinese manufacturing there. So they suspected that they didn't get tested, but they suspected that they probably had the coronavirus back in October. And so this thing was probably here much earlier. By the time they say, hey, we're going to do 2 weeks to slow the spread, I think the spread had already, we were already kind of peaking at that point for the spring surge, if you want to call it that, of coronavirus. And which that's the time of year that people usually, you know, gets pretty sick with the flu and stuff. Late winter is a season where a lot of people get sick. But I just kept thinking, look, people are going to come to their senses. They're going to come to their senses, realize this thing is a mistake. They, you know, and acknowledge, and then let's get back to life. And it just never happened, because no one would ever admit the mistake. And then partway through summer, they realized, yeah, the lockdowns really didn't accomplish much. You know, we didn't need to do them. Schools probably shouldn't have been closed. That was probably a mistake. This is what you hear all summer. And then fall comes and there's a slight surge, and boom, states are right back to the lockdowns, not holding in-person schools. Some schools never even went to in-person. They were stuck with virtual. And it's like, wait, didn't we learn anything here? And it amazes me how this unwillingness to admit when mistakes are made and adjust. Instead, the mistakes just get, it's like you can't talk about them. And this is a whole different thing. But then the election, now you can't even talk. And this is a completely different thing. But the election, well, maybe it is related. The election happens, vote fraud. Now we can't even talk about the vote fraud. But now we can't even talk about a stolen election. It's almost like this charade, this altered reality that if you don't talk about something, it didn't happen. And you can just make all these assumptions and adopt all these things as fact. And when they're not, and again, there's no, there's never a introspective moment where people turn around and assess, look, what do we do, and learn something from it. It just never happens in this country. And that's just sad. Our problems are so fixable. I remember when Trump wanted to say he wanted to get, we did the lockdown thing. And then, you know, it became pretty clear that it wasn't sustainable. We damn near killed the supply chain for food in this country. And And Trump, I remember saying, he's like, yeah, I'd really like to see the country back open by Easter. Wouldn't it be great if everybody, if the churches were full by Easter? So he had the right instincts that to get this thing back rolling, to get the country back moving. And I mean, what they should have done, I mean, Freedom had a solution here. What they should have done right away was say, look, this is what we know. It's a very, for people that are over 65 with these conditions, high blood pressure, obesity, type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure, this thing, you don't do well on it. So those people should be really, really cautious and go out in public with caution. And maybe those people, if you're over 65 with type 2 diabetes, you're obese with type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure, yeah, maybe you should wear an N95, like a real mask that actually filters the virus, not these phony, or have someone do your shopping for you and leave it. I mean, that's how this should have been done. But instead, this killed the economy. And then again, a lot of that stuff got politically motivated. But I kept thinking last year that people are going to come to their senses. They're going to come to their senses. They're going to come to their senses. And we're just going to go. And that never happened. And now here we are a year later. And instead of people saying, yeah, that was, we've even got data now that, did you know that not more people died last year than typically die? There was no, if this coronavirus was so deadly, there hasn't been an abnormal spike in overall deaths. So I've suggested this all along too, because it just makes common sense. The people that would have died from the, and the flu has completely gone away. There's like no cases of the flu out there. There is like no flu season this year. And then they keep saying, again, these people that won't admit mistakes, they keep saying, there's no flu season because everybody's wearing masks and social distancing, which again, the media just repeats. And you got these stupid reporters saying, oh yeah, that's the reason. No, that's not the reason. If these stupid cloth masks and social distancing stopped virus transmission, the coronavirus would be zilch. And honestly, it is almost zilch. I think now there's like 7,000 active cases in the whole state of Wisconsin. There's 6 million people in the state of Wisconsin. I mean, I think at its peak, there was like something around like 40 or 50,000 active cases. But people act like everybody, you know, the person next to you, everybody's sick. Everybody, you know, it's just the coronanoia, the paranoia was unbelievable. But we sit here and we see these, lots of train thoughts. So we here we are a year later, and instead of acknowledging the things that weren't done right, the things that we now know that we have evidence right away, they used to say, oh, we don't know if you'll have immunity. This, you know, you might be able to get right. And that doesn't make sense. We've never had viruses in this country that the human immune system is what dictates that you can't turn around and get the same virus a month later, 2 weeks later. The human immune system, so when they sit there and say we don't know if you'll have immunity after you have coronavirus, we don't know if you have immunity. No bullshit. We do know. Because viruses, you always have immunity to viruses. If you're a healthy person, you get it. And that's the reason why if your family gets sick, someone in your family, then everybody gets it, then it doesn't turn around back to the first person who's been better for 2 weeks. Oh, now they get it again because the last person that's just getting over it, they still are. You have those antibodies that we've known that for decades, that you know, maybe longer. But yeah, they sit here now. So there's been no additional amount of deaths this year. The number of people overall that died is what is typically seen. So people the flu has dropped to nothing, and they say, oh, it's because we're social distancing and we're wearing masks. No bullshit, because if social distancing and wearing masks stopped virus transmission, then it would stop the corona. Masks and, oh, well, no, it's not that the coronavirus is so much more. It's an upper respiratory virus transmitted by droplets just like the flu. And so the fact is, I suspect, and it's a combination of these probably, people are getting the flu and they're calling it coronavirus, or people are getting the coronavirus and dying from it that would have died from the flu anyway, because every year, you know, tens of thousands, some years, 80,000, 100,000 people in this country die from the flu. So we also know that the death numbers are overstated, because even Milwaukee's own medical examiner took issue with, who's a lib, took issue with the state inflating his death numbers by like 25%. And even, I guarantee, even the guy in Milwaukee was still being generous with the coronavirus death toll. I think that if you look at it, what we were really seeing, so my conclusion is, and again, not a scientific one, but based on observation and experience, the people that died from coronavirus are people that probably would have died from the flu. A good number of them certainly would have, because every year, again, 100,000 people, 80,000 people die from the flu. And that's without this insane, paranoid mass testing. I mean, if you tested for the flu, like you've tested for coronavirus, if every time someone got a fever and a cough in years past, they went and got tested, because people get the flu all the time. They don't even go to the doctor. So there's probably a whole bunch more cases of the flu every year than are ever reported or ever confirmed. But yeah, now because the flu is totally gone, they're saying it's because people are wearing social masks and washing their hands and wearing masks, social distancing and washing their hands. It's like, okay, if everybody's doing that so well, how come the coronavirus isn't down to zilch as well? But again, just a refusal. Here we are a year later, and just a refusal to acknowledge facts and realities. And a refusal to do an autopsy of this thing, no pun intended, and say, hey, look, did you know that not more people have died? I mean, when have you heard that on the major networks? Did you know that not more people died this year than any other year? There was not, if coronavirus was this global deadly pandemic, you would think that the number of people dying is, no, it's not. Because see, they can't fake that. You can lie about why someone died, but you can't make up a death. And so all these people that are saying this deadly pandemic, no, it's just, it wasn't. I mean, the people that are dying from coronavirus are likely the ones that would have died if they got the flu. Because every year people, you know, every year people are 1 year older, they're a little bit sicker. And every year, you know, people just, sometimes you just get in a bad, I mean, health situation. You get a cold, that kind of wears you down. Maybe you get a little food poisoning or something, and that's had you down, and then your immunity is kind of weakened, and then boom, then you get hit with a virus, and it affects you more. I mean, gosh, back in 2005, I was young. I mean, in 2005, I was 31, and I got the flu so bad that year. I mean, I had a terrible, terrible case of the flu. I mean, I didn't get better for like, I swear I got the flu in like, maybe it was February, and I didn't get better till like June. It was that bad. I feel like I had a cough for 3 months. It was terrible. Some years it just hits you. Some years you just get to in a place where your immune system's beat down and it just hits you. This is what's happened. This is life. But no, this year it's all coronanoia, paranoia, and it's the end of the world as we know it. And yet after all this, not more people have died. The same number of people that usually die are dying. So there's just, oh, millions of people dead across the globe. Nope. The same amount of people are dying. There's not this excess number. So anyway, but just this refusal to acknowledge just the truth. There's such a fear of the truth in society today. And whether it's, and having honest conversations, whether it's a basketball game and just saying, hey, yeah, that the refs cost them, the refs made a bad call and it cost Wisconsin the game and changed the tone of the game. And just being able to say, but it's sports and bad calls get made. It is what it is. And just acknowledge the reality. Just acknowledge the reality. We didn't need the lockdowns. They were a complete mistake. They were politically driven in many cases. And then instead of admitting they made a mistake, because government never wants to admit it made a mistake, they just keep doubling down on it, because otherwise they'd have egg on their face. Well, they have egg on their, in my opinion, they have egg on their face for not recognizing their errors and doing it again. They think they would have egg on their face if they didn't keep up doing the same things that they had been doing, because to change course would indicate that, yeah, we realized we were wrong last spring. So anyway, last year at this time, this is where we were. We were sitting here. I kept thinking that any day now, people were going to come to their senses and realize that they're way overreacting to this thing, this coronavirus, and it just never happened, and all kinds of reasons for that. So anyway, first thing I was going to talk about tonight was something that really irked me this past week, and that is conservatives don't know how to play offense. And I feel like I should preface this by saying, again, these are all my opinions. Sometimes I state my opinions like they're the gospel truth, and I should preface these by saying this is all my opinions and conclusions. And obviously, I think I'm right. If I didn't think I'm right, I wouldn't say them. But I think sometimes I rub people the wrong way stating things as a fact. Even though I'm not saying, hey, this is a fact, I'm stating it as a making a declaration about it, when it is obviously my opinion. It's an educated opinion, but it's my opinion. But my opinion, my observation is conservatives don't know how to play offense. And here's my latest example. So you've got this Equality Act. If you probably heard about this in the news. The Equality Act is something that the Democrats have introduced in Congress, and nothing about it is equality. So every time I hear this Equality Act, I think to myself, from conservatives, we're repeating the propaganda. And so we have to fight back against this. And it amazes me people see it. And I'm going to say at the beginning of my topic here, this thing should be termed the Inequality Act every time we talk about it. And here's why I say that. Because Republicans now have repeated this a million times since it's been introduced. The Republicans, the Equality Act that's been introduced, sometimes they say the so-called Equality Act, but they repeat that Equality Act over and over. Conservatives on the radio, conservatives on TV, One America News, Newsmax, all I've been hearing, Equality Act, over and over and over. And libs love this. And this is a decades-old problem. I mean, look at Affordable Care Act, Obama's Affordable Care Act. So this is propaganda, and the Democrats do it on purpose because it's proven historically how the big lies work. You just repeat something enough, and it becomes the truth. But there's an easy way to wag the dog on this one, but no conservatives figure it out because, I don't know, conservatives, I seem to think they're too used to capturing outrage from their followers and supporters. Too many conservatives, their tactic is to capture the outrage of their own followers and their own supporters instead of playing offense against their adversaries. Again, notable pattern for conservatives. And I'll say that again because it's my core point. Conservatives are too focused on capturing outrage from their followers and their supporters instead of playing offense against their adversaries. They're too busy, stated differently, they're too busy preaching to the choir and reveling in the amens that they don't either A, go out and witness to the uninformed masses about the truth or an alternative point of view, or B, they go straight at and defeat their adversaries. That's what they should be doing, is going straight at and trying to defeat their adversaries. But again, Republicans are too busy preaching to the choir and reveling in the amens that they don't go out and witness to the uninformed masses, and they don't go straight at and try to defeat their adversaries. And so then, I mean, I recognize this over and over, that Republicans, they love to just sit the misery. If you're a conservative, misery loves company. You love complaining about all those damn liberals and they're doing this or doing that. But nobody turns around and fights. Everybody complains about this liberal bullshit. Everybody complains about political correctness. Everybody complains about this stuff, but then nobody turns around and fights. It's just like misery loves company. Hey, let's all be miserable about it together. But then they never fight and do anything about it. But again, there's an easy way to wag the dog in this one. So I'm now have assessed what conservatives do wrong. So how do we play offense? And I'm glad you asked. First off, we need to call these things what it is. We need to take it right back at the liberals. This Inequality Act, the Equality Act, we need to call it the Inequality Act every time we talk about it. Just label it. Oops, let me turn my computer sound down here. Label it what it is. It's the Inequality Act and call it that. So whether it's conservative talk media, or excuse me, conservative talk radio, whether it's the anchors on Newsmax or wherever, what they need to do is start referring to these things by our names. The Equality Act, refer to it as the Inequality Act. And then you'd say, well, I don't want to mislead people about if they go calling their senator and saying, hey, vote against the Inequality Act, they'll figure it out. And you can make reference to it once, but just keep calling it the Inequality Act. And here's the reason, because let me use another example first. The Affordable Care Act, that should be dubbed the Unaffordable Care Act. And that's easy. It's still identifiable. You still know what you're talking about. But it's playing offense. And here's the thing. Liberals hawk on conservatives like vultures over a dying wild horse. Liberals are just waiting for conservatives to stumble because it gives an opening, and wham, they swoop in to cancel culture and whatever. So my point is that conservatives will throw a hissy fit. Liberals will throw a hissy fit. Because liberals are so proud of their names that they give their bills and all stuff. When you call the Equality Act what it is, the Inequality Act, and use that term over and over, liberals, their hair will start on fire. First, they'll get all ninny, bitchy, and frothy at the mouth, and they'll say, no, it's the Equality Act, it's the Equality Act. But then they'll be forced to defend it. And you and I both know that the Inequality Act is indefensible. You and I both know the stuff in these bills would make even non-political people's heads spin. So again, wag the dog. Call it the Inequality Act every moment, every second, over TV, over the radio, conservative talkers on the radio, social media, on fascist book, on Twitter, on Parler, whatever. Refer to it. Call it the name, label it the Inequality Act, label it the Unaffordable Care Act. And it could be, when it comes to the Second Amendment, if the Democrats, because they're going to give it some funny, they're going to introduce some crime prevention or gun crime prevention act. Instead, call it the Second Amendment Destruction Act. I mean, we got to name these things with our names, so that we're not sitting here repeat, because for the thousands of times that conservatives, again, on Fox News, if there's still any left on Fox News, but Newsmax, One America News, conservative talk radio, they keep saying the Equality Act, the Equality Act, the Equality Act. They're perpetuating that propaganda. So call it what it is. Call it the Inequality Act. Call it the Unaffordable Care Act. And the next thing down the pike, the Gun Violence Prevention Act of 2021, call it the Second Amendment Destruction Act of 2021. Just keep calling it that. Don't perpetuate the propaganda. But right now, this past week, everybody from Stinchfield and Dan O'Donnell and Mark Belling and Brian Stile on talk radio, every pundit, every Republican politician, they take the bait and they let libs dictate their vocabulary. They let Republicans sell the liberal horseshit with every news clip, every segment, every post. And we got to fight back, and that's just one way to do it. One way to wag the dog is stop repeating their propaganda names for these bills, these programs. I'm going to continue to rail on liberals here. I thought of this angle 2 weeks ago when I was driving home from the gym, and this is weird. Remember now, it's, you know, we've had warm weather here in Wisconsin for a week here, so, but a couple weeks ago, we were still in like the cold. We had 3 feet of snow on the ground. But the basis of liberal government, the liberal philosophy of government, is rooted in inequality. I was thinking about this driving home from the gym this past week. So I drive past this subdivision in New Berlin called Red Fox Crossing. And I see the solar panels on the roofs, and I talked last week on the show, or maybe it was the week before, about how these solar panels, they're such a joke, and that it's a novelty. The only reason that solar panels are a, quote, viable form of alternative energy here in Wisconsin is because we have a reliable form of energy called the power grid. And the only thing that makes solar power possible for these homes in Wisconsin at Red Fox Crossing is two things. One, the tax credits to make them financially feasible, and two, the power grid to make them physically feasible, to make it physically feasible to have solar power. Because if you don't have the power grid, I'm driving by and I see these solar panels covered in a foot of snow for 3 weeks straight here in Wisconsin, and they ain't producing any electricity. Those houses are all hooked up to the power grid, and so then they just start taking power from the power grid. The point I made a couple weeks ago is, you don't save anything because production capacity for electricity isn't based upon average usage. production capacity is based upon peak usage. When you have the, you can't store up electricity. I mean, you could put it in batteries, but look, batteries in a big enough capacity to power a city for 3 weeks, that those don't exist. You can't store enough electricity in battery packs to power cities for 3 weeks. So production capacity from a utility standpoint has to be based upon peak demand. You have to have enough power plants so that when demand is at its peak, and when is it at its peak? Well, either during the summer when it's 101 degrees and everybody's running their AC, or in the winter when it's -5 degrees and everybody's running their heat and their, you know, every space heaters and everything else. That's when you get your peak demand. And in the winter, when you get peak demand, you don't have anybody getting solar power. Well, sometimes you do, but there's a very good possibility that you won't be getting solar power because of clouds and snow. Many cloudy days, and then many days where you've got snow on the roofs. So peak demand, you don't get to say, oh, well, look at all these houses now. 25% of homes have solar panels. So let's reduce, so we can eliminate 25% of our power plant capacity. We don't need as many power plants. No, you still need all those power plants because in the winter, when it's cloudy and below zero and there's snow on the solar panels, you need all that capacity. So you don't save anything from an economic standpoint, from a total, when you look at the aggregate. But that's not really my point. That was what I did a topic on 2 weeks ago. But the angle I'm going to drive at today is, so I'm driving home, I'm looking at these solar panels, and if it made sense, the free market has a solution here, because if solar panels were viable, people would buy them, and people would even pay a little bit more to do the right thing. It's called psychological value. People would pay a little bit more to, quote, do the right thing. And so I was thinking about that. I was thinking how people do the right thing. When it's economically viable, people adapt and adopt new practices. Even throughout history, when we had environmental polluters, it wasn't government that solved that problem. It was the free market. People saw that it wasn't sustainable the way that things were done. It wasn't sustainable to dump sewers into lakes and rivers, and because we saw how people got sick. And then so it didn't take the government to say, you can't dump and, you know, that was figured out by the free market. You know, it wasn't sustainable to pollute land. It wasn't sustainable to cut down a bunch of trees for companies realize that. Lumber companies realize, look, if we just keep cutting trees, we're going to run out of trees. So they realized they had to plant more trees than they cut, because they don't just need to plant enough trees to replace what they cut down. They need to plant enough trees for the growth in lumber production in the future. So capitalism does address environmental issues also, but here's the kicker. Liberals don't trust that process. Liberals don't trust the free market, because the free market is people making decisions that are best for them. So liberals always, and you'll always say it, same thing with like charity. Conservatives would say, yeah, if there's really people in need, that's what charity is for. And liberals say, well, people won't donate to charity, so we need the government to force them to donate, or to force government programs, because people won't. Liberals don't trust people. It's their philosophy is based upon it. Because if let me take the other direction. If liberals trusted people to do the right thing, then they wouldn't need to propose all these government mandates, because people would do the right thing. They would do the right thing for the environment. They would do the right thing for charity, for helping people that were truly down on their luck that needed a helping hand. But liberals don't believe that without the force of government, that people would do the right thing. So inherently, liberals believe by definition that some people must be smarter than others because they get to tell other people how to live. Let me explain that there. If liberals think that you need government because people can't be trusted to make the right choices, because people won't do the right thing, because companies won't do the right thing. Again, companies are just made up of people. People are making those decisions. There's not yet robots that make all these decisions. So what liberals are saying is we can't trust individuals to do the right things when it comes to the environment, when it comes to charity and helping people that need a helping hand, a handout. charity. Liberals don't believe that you can trust people. You can't leave people to their own devices because they won't do it. People won't do the right thing for the environment. They won't do the right thing for people in need. So they're going to put government in charge of that. But that must mean that someone in government, the liberals who are making these rules and these laws, well, they must know better. They must be smarter because they know. They get to tell other people how to live. That's the inequality right there. If people, liberals believe that they must inherently be smarter than other people, because if everybody was as smart as a liberal, if everybody had the right to think like a liberal and think of they know what's best, you wouldn't need all these government mandates. So if the government, if liberals' belief that people can't be trusted, and they'll say it, they'll say, why don't you just let people look? If people want to put solar panels on their house when it makes sense, why should they do it? Why do we need government incentives? They'll say, well, because people won't do the right thing. People won't do the right thing. They'll say, why do we need, you know, this and this and this? Because, you know, people don't want to, people want to see clean rivers and clean streams. Well, people won't do the right thing. Why do we need to take money from people when there's charities to help out? Charity could help out people in need. And they'll say, well, people won't, you know, we can't trust people to, people won't, you know, they don't trust people to step up and help in those charitable situations. So therefore, they're so smart that they can set these government policies to do what people aren't smart enough to do on their own. Or that is rooted in inequality. Because if some people didn't need to be told how to live their lives and be forced to live their lives a certain way by smarter people, then capitalism would be just fine. So how can you deny that the liberal progressive philosophy is based on inequality? The liberal philosophy is based upon inequality. Liberals in their heads don't trust other people. They trust themselves and they trust their woke lefties. They believe their woke lefties are, because look, if everybody thought you just have a right, look, you should be able to make your own decisions for yourself, that's equality. But liberals believe that people won't make the right decisions, so other people have to make decisions for them. That's inequality. It's based upon, the liberal philosophy is based upon inequality. So I was just thinking about that as I was driving home from the gym, and it's, there's so many other ways that there's the immorality of the liberal philosophy, the Democrat philosophy. The immorality of it all is just so stark to me. And when I say immoral, like I'll use one other example. There's a guy at the gym who said to me, he's from Russia, and he's like, oh, he saw me on the news doing an interview with Wisconsin Kerry for one of the networks. He said, oh, I saw you on the news talking about guns. And I said, yeah. And he said, and I, whenever someone brings it up, I'm like, oh, here we go. It's going to bring me someone that's pro-gun. And I could just tell this guy was going to be anti. He goes, yeah, I don't agree. I don't think people should be able to own guns. And I was like, well, that's nice. And, you know, because I don't even engage people anymore. But this guy just kept going. He goes, yeah, and he's just waiting for me. So this guy at the gym, he says, yeah, I don't think people should be able to own guns. And I was like, oh, that's nice. I do. And then he says, I'm from Russia. And, you know, if people want to hunt or whatever, they should, like, be able to go check out a gun and take it hunting and then return the gun back when they're. And I just, again, the guy's, he's an immigrant from Russia. But then he said to me, he's like, because I'm not engaging with this fucker. And he says to me, he's like, well, I hope you respect my opinion. And I said to him, no, I don't respect your opinion. Because he's like, you know, I respect your opinion, but I hope you respect mine. I said, no, I don't respect your opinion. You have a right to have it. But here's the thing. See, Democrats think that on the anti-gun issue, Democrats think that their position deserves equal standing. I believe if someone wants to own a gun, they should be able to own a gun and whatever gun they want. So I believe this guy doesn't think people should be able to own a gun, and I think people should be able to own a gun. And he thinks that those are equal positions. He thinks that his position is just as moral as my position, but it's not, because my position is that I should be able to own a gun. My position is, if my an equal position was that I think he should be forced to own a gun. See, he thinks that I shouldn't be able to own a gun, and he thinks that I should respect his opinion because it's equal standing to mine. But my opinion has no effect on him or how he lives his life. His opinion has an effect on how I live my life. So you see, this is, again, this is the immorality of the liberal progressive argument, of the liberal progressive mindset. They think that that's a moral equivalence. He thinks that people shouldn't be able to own guns. I think that they should. But I don't believe that people should be forced. He believes that I should be, that someone else should. If he doesn't want to own a gun, fine, don't own a gun. That's the opposite of his position would be that I think people should be forced to own a gun. That's the opposite of his position, but I'm not the opposite. I'm of the free position. I want to own a gun, but you don't have to. So if you don't want a gun, then you, that's what he should say to me. The equal position is if he says to me, well, I don't like guns, so I don't own one, but I respect your right to own one. That's an equal position. So I would respect, if he said to me, I hope you respect my choice not to buy a gun, I'd say, sure, I disagree with it, but I respect your choice not to wear, to buy a gun. I would never want to force you to buy a gun if you don't want one. I respect your choice. But he wants me to respect his, he didn't, that's not what he was asking. He was asking me that I should respect his opinion that I shouldn't be able to own a gun. Bullshit. I don't respect that. And that's what I told him. I said, I don't respect that opinion. I said, if you don't want to, if you chose not to buy a gun, I respect your choice not to buy one. But you want me to not buy a gun. You think I shouldn't be able to own a gun. Now you want me to respect your belief that I shouldn't be able to own one? That's a bridge too far. So again, this is where there's so many instances where there's the immorality of liberal policies, the immorality of liberal philosophies. And you can see it over and over again. The next thing I had on my thing here, and I had this queued up for a couple weeks ago, and my brother-in-law was listening, and he was mad that I didn't get to it. Woke Coke. So you guys probably have heard this on the news. You know, now Coca-Cola, they've got this white cultural sensitivity training that they're doing for their employees. I guess there was some online training seminar manual something, and then this is reported in the news, and how Coke was suggesting that their employees need to act less white and all stuff. Just completely racist stuff. Just completely racist stuff. But here's my thing. Here's where I'm going with this. The 80 million people who voted for Trump and the America First sentiment, they need to use their power as consumers. I mean, if some kids on Reddit can squeeze hedge funds into billion-dollar losses, this is, I'm talking about the GameStop stock thing that you guys have probably heard about in the news. If some kids on Reddit, and I don't know if they were all kids, but some millennials, kids, whatever, on Reddit can squeeze hedge funds into billion-dollar losses by collectively taking action to start purchasing stocks in companies that these hedge funds had short sold. I won't get into the mechanism how that works, but you could read about it. It's just too much to go off into a tangent on this show. I've done it before, talked about it before on the show, but we conservatives need to be willing to impart some swift and intense boycotts. And see, this is another example where conservatives, conservatives are always afraid to engage in symmetrical warfare. So it's always asymmetrical warfare. Liberals will do shit that conservatives would never do. Now, there's some stuff that we shouldn't do because it's just immoral. Liberals want to infringe upon the right to free speech, and conservatives, like, we don't believe that. So we don't want to infringe on liberals' free speech because we believe in all free speech. But there's other instances where, like, for example, boycotts. You know, conservatives find it, I think, distasteful to boycott, because they don't want to be boycotted. But this is one of the examples, or one of the situations, where we got to get over that and start playing offense. Do you realize how quickly we could have Coke on national television apologizing and begging for forgiveness when this crap comes out about their cultural sensitivity training that's telling people to act less white? Because again, if some kids on Reddit can squeeze hedge funds and collectively create a movement to squeeze hedge funds into billion-dollar losses, to the point that some hedge funds said, hey, we're no longer going to short sell stock. Because what these, again, I call them kids, what these people did on these Reddit forums, these Wall Street Bets forums on Reddit that just start buying, you have to, it's published data. When companies have their stock shorted, it's published data. And so these Wall Street Bets groups on Reddit can just continue. If these hedge funds decided, okay, well, they short squeezed us out of GameStop. We're going to go short squeeze Cost headphones. That was another one of these companies. We're going to go short squeeze Bed Bath & Beyond. We're going to go short squeeze AMC movie theaters. Or we're going to go short the stock for those. Then that's published information. So these Reddit groups could then just go and start doing the same things for all those other companies that the hedge funds were trying to show. So the hedge fund said, hey, look, we're no longer going to short sell stock as an investment strategy. They just got out of the short selling game because, so again, if these kids on Reddit can do that, we conservatives are the majority. Democrats can't wage real boycotts because they don't have the numbers. Democrats can only flash these phony outrage, social media bot driven charades. Democrat boycotts virtually never work because the outrage is phony and it's manufactured on social media. I saw this back with Starbucks when they asked people not to open carry in their coffee shops. I saw it with Chipotle. I saw it with Target. What these anti-gun groups would do is through social media, they would flood the social media of Starbucks. They would flood the social media of Target, asking them not to allow people to open carry, of Chipotle. And these executives who live in some ivory tower, these multimillionaire executives who live in some ivory tower, they don't go walk the floors of the stores. They, I mean, you know, maybe they do as a, you know, photo op a couple times a year. But they're just disconnected from real people, these rich executives. And then all they see is on social media, they're getting hammered. And they perceive that to be, this is indicative. And before it manifests itself in lost sales, they change their policy. But Starbucks had never saw a hit to their people had said they weren't going to ship to get Starbucks coffee until Starbucks banned open carry. Starbucks never saw a sales hit. People that would say, hey, we're not going to shop at Target unless you prohibit open carry. Target never saw a sales drop. That their decision to prohibit open carry wasn't based upon sales drop. It was based upon social media saturation. So they keep sitting here thinking that this attack that they're seeing on social media is indicative of what, how their customers feel. And they're going to be get out in front of it by taking preemptive action to again, ban open carry. But some of it was bots. Some of it was real people with real social media, liberals with social media accounts, but the majority of it was just bots. And again, it was, so if they see, you know, on a typical day, Target would see 300 people comment on their social media for various things. And then all of a sudden one day, 3,000 people comment, you better ban open carry, you better ban open carry. The guy, the executive from Target, or even the executive of the, you know, social, the interactive division of Target that handles their social media, they can't go and research every single person commenting and say, okay, is this a real person or is this just a bot? Because if they did, what they'd realize is, and some people have gone and done that research, and they realize, hey, this is phony. This is a very small group of people making these companies think that there's this big groundswell of support for a particular issue, example, banning open carry, when it's really not. So Democrats can't wage real boycotts. They can only flash these phony outrage, social media driven charades that fool companies into thinking that they're getting out in front of the issue and preventing a boycott by quickly making a change. But Democrat boycotts virtually never work because the outrage is phony. It's manufactured on social media. It's not a really significant number of their customers. But the companies never – if it was widely reported that Target allowed open carry and then it became a media thing and then Target started to see sales, Target said, we're going to honor state law. If you have a right to carry, if it's legal to carry in your state, you can carry in our stores. If all of a sudden then they saw a sales drop, okay, well, that would be a reason because your customers have spoken. But that's not what they did. They, as soon as social media spoke, as soon as a couple thousand people on social media spoke, boom, they caved. It never affected their bottom line. They never saw that their customers actually felt that way. But again, my point is that we conservatives, we know we're the majority. Back to Coke, a swift and intense boycott from 10 or 20 million conservatives, because you got to look, 80 million people voted for Trump, I believe. The counted votes were, 75 million? But let's be real, with the voting machine fraud that almost certainly existed with those Dominion machines, they're saying 80 million votes is probably about what Trump got. That would have been a landslide. If just 10 or 20 million conservatives who are really pissed off and really sick of this racist woke culture, if 10 or 20 million people said, hey, we're not going to buy Coke for 2 weeks, Coke would see the sales drop and Coke would be on national TV begging for forgiveness, ripping the critical race theory bullshit and all this, racial sensitivity crap out of their training program instantly. When I say instantly, within weeks. So conservatives need to get over their propensity to play nice and be willing to defeat cancel culture with symmetrical warfare. Sticking on the woke police thing, I have a confession, and I've confessed this in the show before, but I watched The Bachelor with my fiance. When I started dating her, she watched it. We ended up sitting watching it together. And I first loved watching it because this is why I do love watching it. I love watching it for the drama. It's an interesting insight into human behavior because, of course, it's for TV and it's edited, but there is an amount of real – look, this is how real people act when they're on national TV filming a TV show. But you still get insight into human behavior. It's still a data-rich environment for human behavior, watching these – how the premise of The Bachelor, for those who don't know, is there's one guy and there's 30 girls and he – gets to know them, meets them, dates them, and then narrows it down to the one that he's going to ask to marry him or whatever. But throughout the process, you get drama. You get to see women getting catty with other women the situation, the dynamic there of one guy dating 30 girls and narrowing it down to it creates some hella drama. And so that's why I find it fascinating because the insight into human behavior. And again, it's not the same kind of data that you would get if you were to be a spy on the wall of a company and watching how people act in the break room and this and that, because it's different, because these girls know they're on national TV. They're not necessarily acting like they really would act. They're acting how they would act when they know that what they're doing is on national TV. Now, sometimes you get some behaviors where you're like, hey, I think that's probably how that person really is. And that's part of the wonder of the process of The Bachelor, is that you get these girls' emotions involved and then they kind of start acting like they forget that they're on TV and acting like they might really act in that situation. It's fascinating. Anyway, so I watched The Bachelor with my fiance, not because I care who the guys date, whether I just think it's fascinating to watch these girls get catty. And then on the flip side, it's fascinating watching guys. It's some of these guys that they're, because when it's The Bachelorette, then there's one girl and there's 30 guys. And when you're watching The Bachelorette and there's 30 guys altogether, and the guys start getting catty like women. They start tattling on other guys. Oh, this guy's not here for the right reason. But it's fascinating to see how people behave. And again, with the asterisks of this, how people behave when they're on a nationally televised television production, but it's still data that you can observe. It's interesting. So the host of The Bachelor's name is Chris Harrison. So he does an interview this season. It's the first time they've had a black bachelor. They've had a black bachelorette and they've had black contestants. When I say contestants, they're contestants. I guess that's fair to call them that. If there's a white bachelor and he's got 30 women to choose from. Some of those women have been Black, Latino, whatever, throughout, you know, the course of the shows since it's been going on for, I know the show's got to be like, I don't know, it's at least 20 years, maybe almost. I don't know when it started. But so then there, when there's a white bachelorette, there's been Black dudes amongst the pool of dating guys for her, but there's never been a Black bachelor. There's been a Black bachelorette. Her name was Lindsay something. I forget. Something Lindsay. Anyway, her last name was Lindsay. So Chris Harrison, the host of The Bachelor, he's doing an interview with this. Oh, what the hell's her name? Something Lindsay. She was the bachelorette too. Rachel Lindsay. So Rachel Lindsay was the first Black bachelorette. And now she does like a podcast or something, or she's like maybe she's a correspondent for Extra or whatever. But anyway, so she's interviewing Chris Harrison, who's the host of the Bachelor Bachelorette franchise. And apparently one of the girls on this season, she was at a sorority party in college, which for her was probably 5 years ago, 3 years ago, whatever, because these are young girls, mid-20s. So maybe 5 years ago, she was at a sorority party, and they dressed up in the antebellum style, which is like the pre-Civil War Southern plantation, you know, big, white, poofy dress, Southern belle style. She was at an antebellum themed, you know, it wasn't a slavery themed sorority party. This is like 5 years ago in antebellum, but now that's wrong too, because that's celebrating the Civil War heritage, and that's, you know, wrong according to the cancel culture. So Chris Harrison is doing an interview, and this picture shows up of this one of the contestants from this season who's trying to, she's one of the final four or whatever that the Black bachelor is still dating, because he's narrowing it down to his final one. And so on social media, this picture of this one girl, Rachel Kirkconnell or something like that, shows up of her at this antebellum style sorority party. And he says, Rachel Lindsay, the former Black bachelorette who's interviewing Chris Harrison, says, you know, don't you find this terrible? And Chris Harrison says, well, hold on a minute. You know, I haven't talked to Rachel Kirkconnell, the girl who's seen in a picture at this sorority party dressed in the antebellum style. Let's have a little grace. Let her speak for herself. And he didn't instantly come out and condemn her for it. And then he referred to some term. He's like, you know, before the woke police attack her, that's, you know, instantly he's in the crosshairs. He's racially insensitive. And so within a day, he comes out with this massive apology, tucks tail and genuflects at the altar of the woke gods. But I think his initial response is appropriate. I think it was honest. His initial comments were like, hey, this cancel culture is ridiculous, and we're not going to sit here and rain fire and brimstone on this Rachel Kirkconnell girl just because she was at a sorority party. He's like, you know, 5 years ago, he's like, yeah, in 2021, that's not cool. But in 2018 or whenever it wasn't as big of a thing. It wasn't considered racially insensitive at that point. But now the woke race culture is retroactive. You can go back in someone's history, and if you find anything throughout their whole life that was racially insensitive, you can cancel them now in 2021, even if back in the context of the time and period, it was okay. Of course, this doesn't apply to liberal politicians Joe Biden makes racist jokes about you can't go into a convenience store, a convenience store in New Jersey unless you speak Farsi. But you know that they don't go back to that. But so Chris Harrison, his initial response, I think, was indicative that even people in Hollywood are sick of this woke bullshit. But then within a day, you know, he comes out and does this massive apology. And I think his comments since, I'm not sure if he really had a change of heart or if he's just doing and saying what he has to say to survive this woke inquisition. But I can't help but suspect that deep down, there's a lot of people in Hollywood, a lot of people in the mainstream media who are just, they absolutely reject this woke culture bullshit, but they're just putting the money first. But that's, it's festering. I feel like this, there's I mean, you can't even go a day. Last week on the show, I was talking about how Jeep, and now it's the companies doing it themselves. Nobody has protested Jeep because they have Jeep Cherokee, but Jeep Cherokee on their own, and maybe they were contacted by some Cherokee native elder or something, but Jeep says that they're going to thinking about changing the name of the Jeep Cherokee. And then I made the comment on my Well-Armed Radio MeWe page. How come, so Jeep has a vehicle they call the Jeep Patriot. I consider myself a patriot. I'm not offended that there's a vehicle named after me. So how come someone names a vehicle a Jeep Patriot and patriots aren't offended, but someone names, but Jeep has a vehicle called the Jeep Cherokee and that's offensive to Indians, to Cherokee Indians? It doesn't make any sense. Why in the hell would that be offensive? Again, if they name a car the Ford Superstar, are Superstars going to be offended? No. I think it's cool. Cars named, I mean, of course, it's not an individual. But this whole thing is just, I can't help but think that there's a whole bunch of people that aren't even necessarily conservatives in any way, but they're getting sick of this woke bullshit as well. So sticking with this racist sentiment that everything in this country now, we've gone from a country that was told by Martin Luther King to not judge people by the color of their skin, but to judge them by the content of their character. And all of a sudden now, all we care about is the color of people's skin, and we ignore the content of their character. If you have color in your skin, we ignore the content of your character. But here's where there's a jump. And, you know, as anyone knows, this racist saturation diversity social mission has been ongoing for quite some time, but it's been largely a cultural thing. Some might say it's trendy, but now surely there are many affirmative action things in the past that were codified into statutes. Like when I was in college, it was a big thing, like affirmative action, like it was codified that colleges would admit people with lower grades and lower, if they were African-American, they had a lower grade point requirement, lower SAT requirement to get admitted into the school. And so that was called affirmative action. And it kind of over time took on a negative connotation. But so this has been codified before, these racially judgmental government policies, whether it's a law or a regulation or a. So again, these have made their way into statutes before. But what was once something of a free market, and by a free market, I mean a forced market using social media influence to push this whole forced diversity agenda. Again, that was mostly something that happened in the free market. Again, when I say free market, I'm putting free market in air quotes because that was the free market, but it was still being influenced by, you know, TV media, social media. So it wasn't, you know, but now the hands of government are being used to really drive this racist diversity conquest. And this was from the La Crosse Tribune. And I'll just read real quick from this article here. Because this one raised my eyebrows because it's a jump. Wisconsin regulators seek workforce diversity energy burden data from utilities. This is back from February 16th. This is on published in the La Crosse Tribune, and it says, "Oh, now I gotta take. I've looked at this article too many times now. I gotta do that little survey." For the first time, Wisconsin regulators are requiring utilities to report on the diversity of their workforces and suppliers as well as the portion of household income their customers spend on energy. The Public Service Commission announced Monday that all 609 regulated electric, gas, and water utilities must include demographic information on their employees and boards of directors in their annual reports to the agency. The PSC, Public Service Commission, is asking for data on race, ethnicity, gender, disabilities, and veteran status for workers at all investor-owned and municipal utilities. In addition, investor-owned utilities with at least 15,000 customers must provide information on their suppliers, including procurement goals and actual spending with businesses owned by minorities, veterans, women, LGBT individuals, or people with disabilities. So there's more to this article, but I'm going to stop there. It's one thing for all these companies, whether it's Northwestern Mutual Life and Johnson Controls, to have their, and again, this is my opinion, to have their pandering diversity initiatives. You know, I read the Milwaukee Business Journal cover to cover every week, and it's a total liberal rag, but it's the only Milwaukee business publication. But you really have to wade through about 40% of their content lately, especially in the last 6 months, is just 9 months maybe, is being social justice propaganda. You know, since last May, June, the social justice political content in the Milwaukee Business Journal is just over the top. Lately, they have these Neighborhood Achiever series monthly where they highlight businesses from people of color, but they grasp at just completely non-news insignificant businesses. Like there's one-man shops and two-people partnerships and non-operational entities that are more like hobby businesses than revenue businesses. And there's nothing wrong with those businesses, but it's, you know, it's not newsworthy for the Milwaukee business community. But there's been this diversity initiative and after diversity initiative. So these special report series, they have to just scrounge up to find things to include in their reporting. And so much so they have to go down to very small businesses to find content for these diversity special reports in the newspaper, the Milwaukee Business Journal. So then they've got their diversity in business awards and their diversity in business virtual roundtables. I mean, it's so forced and so phony. But again, most of this stuff is just media pushing their political agenda and businesses voluntarily trying to be, quote, woke and follow the cheese dangled by the media to gain favorable reporting. But private businesses choosing to partake in all of this stuff. But this is the jump here. Now the Wisconsin regulatory agency, the Public Service Commission, which I think the people on there are appointed by the governor, if I'm not mistaken. But this is a governmental agency. They're asking, that's what totally caught my eye in the article, is when they said Wisconsin regulators seek data on workforce diversity, because that raised my eyebrows, and that's a jump. So now it's not just this, you know, businesses can, they can choose to, if they want to, you know, have some diversity program in their company or some diversity initiative that they're going to, I think it's racist, but they're going to assess people not on the content of their skills, not on the content of their character, but on the color of their skin. But that's fine if companies want to be racist and judge people on the color of their skin. But here, this is the government demanding this data. And of course, by asking for the data, you know they're going to start to probably mandate. And so that's where we're getting this jump where this whole woke culture is going from just being a quote free market initiative to something that's going to be forced with the power of government. And that's a jump. That's, some people might say, yeah, well, this woke culture bullshit's been all over every place anyway. And that's kind of true, but it hasn't been forced and it hasn't been, it's been the power of media, not necessarily the power of government. And now, of course, not that there weren't politicians pushing it, but here's actual regulatory agencies that are going to use their power as a regulatory agency likely to start pushing their race-driven outcomes through regulations, through statutes, through, you know, through the force of government. And that's a jump. That's something that where we haven't been with this whole woke bullshit. So, this is probably the last topic I'll do tonight. real quick, how to recapture Wisconsin. This has been a bummer for me because, you know, I'm sitting here bummed out about how we had an election stolen from us and bummed out about the prospects of how do we look. Wisconsin's either a purple state or a blue state now because we have a Democrat governor, and with what I believe was vote fraud in the last election, we have, until we get election reform, how could we have an honest and fair election? I think that we did win the hearts and minds. Trump did win the hearts and minds of Wisconsinites in 2020, but because of vote fraud in Milwaukee specifically, and Madison, but to the largest extent Milwaukee, we weren't able to recognize the victory that I believe we had here in Wisconsin. So then I say to myself, what good does it do me to go around and say to people, hey, you got to support pro-gun candidates, you got to support, you know, pro-gun governors and candidates for governor, when we could win, we could convince people, but it's going to be stolen at the ballot box. So we need election reform in Wisconsin, but how do we get election reform when Tony Evers would veto any bill, I believe, that would lead to election reform? How do we get election reform when the Supreme Court already, because of Brian Jagadorn, siding with the liberals on all and refusing to hear these election cases and so on and so forth. So it leaves us in a position, look, states like, there's other states where they've got Republican governors, Republican assemblies, and they had vote fraud in them. I think Georgia might be one of them. Arizona might be one, but they believe they had vote fraud. They're changing their election laws to make it harder to cheat. But in Wisconsin, though, I don't think we're able to get any changes in laws because Tony Evers wants the cheating. It benefits him. I believe Scott Walker won his last election because the same scenario happened late night hours or early morning hours of election night. Boom. Absentee ballots from Milwaukee. And all of a sudden, no, Tony Evers won by 20,000 votes. Huh, same margin of victory that Trump lost by. But here's a plan. As I'm sitting here looking through this and as I've kind of dealt with the frustration of the past November, December, January, February, the past 4 months of thinking, how do we move forward from here? Because, you know, I think we're over the cliff. We're not a free country. When you have a stolen election, we are not a free country. When the will of the people don't dictate, we've always been the consent of the governed, and maybe there's been elections stolen before, and, you know, vote fraud, certainly in Chicago, there's some documented cases where there's been vote fraud, but by and large, I think we had a president that was chosen by the consent of the governed. I think Obama won both times because he was trendy and popular and shitty president, but I do believe the majority of people voted for him. The majority of people voted for Trump he didn't win the popular vote, but the electoral majority voted for Trump in 2016. But I believe that Trump won in a landslide this last time, except for vote fraud. So here's what I was thinking. So Wisconsin has 33 senators. So as I'm sitting here trying to find a way to find some optimism, some way to move forward and fight, Wisconsin has 33 senators. There's currently 21 Republicans and 12 Democrats. We only need one more state senator, and we've got a veto-proof majority. Because in Wisconsin, if you can override a governor's veto, but it takes two-thirds of the legislature. So the Senate, there's 33 senators. We currently have 21. There's 21 Republicans, 12 Democrats. We need one. So I went down and I listed the Democrat state senators who are not in Madison and Milwaukee, because in Madison and Milwaukee, I believe that even if you were to convince those places, the people, the voters, to vote for a Republican, that the vote fraud would mitigate that. So, but some of these other places, I don't think that there's the vote fraud machine. So I went through Janice Ringhand. She's from Evansville. Jeff Smith, he's from Eau Claire. Janet Bewley, she's from Bayfield. John Erpenbach, he's from West Point, Lodi area. Brad Pfaff, he's from La Crosse, and Robert Wirch from Kenosha. Those are all Democrat state senators And again, I'm not including the ones in Milwaukee because like Senator Lena Taylor, she's a Democrat senator, but she's in Milwaukee. Even if the majority of people in Milwaukee voted for someone besides Lena Taylor for state senator, I believe that I believe that vote fraud could be used to overcome that. So I looked for places outside of these places where I don't think we have free and fair elections. That means Madison, Milwaukee. So we just need to pick up one of those state senators. The assembly, one of those state senators, and all of a sudden we have a veto proof majority in the, because I don't think it only takes two thirds. I don't think it takes two thirds plus one. I think it's two thirds, which would be 22 Republicans for the Senate, Wisconsin Senate. The assembly, we've got 99 assembly reps, 99 assembly districts in the state of Wisconsin. There's currently 61 Republicans and 38 Democrats, so we need five. So I went down and I looked at all of the Democrat assembly people who are not from Milwaukee or Madison, and there are, let me count here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. About 22. I counted those fast, so I might be wrong. So we've got 61 Republicans, 38 Democrats. We need to pick up five seats to have a veto-proof majority in the assembly. Deb Andraka from Whitefish Bay, she just beat Jim Ott. That was a seat that was very close race. Jim Ott was a Republican. Jill Billings from La Crosse, Sue Conley from Janesville, Dave Considine from Baraboo, Steve Doyle from La Crosse, Jody Emerson from Eau Claire, Gordon Hintz from Oshkosh, Tip McGuire from Kenosha, Beth Myers from Bayfield, Nick Milroy from Douglas County, Greta Neubauer from Racine, Todd Olmstead from Kenosha, Sandy Pope from Mount Horeb, Sarah Rodriguez from Brookfield, Katrina Shanklin from Stevens Point, Christina Shelton from Green Bay, Lee Snodgrass from Appleton, Mary Spreitzer from Beloit, Robin Vining from Wauwatosa, Dan Reamer from West Allis, and Dan Verwink from Milton. If we just picked up five of those, flipped five of those seats, we'd have a veto-proof majority in the assembly. Then we've got veto-proof majorities, then we could pass election reform, and boom, that's how we could salvage Wisconsin. As soon as we have election reform, now don't get me wrong, the Democrats are going to turn around and probably challenge every law that we pass for election reform. They're going to file lawsuits for every law that we pass for election reform, but those lawsuits are going to take a while to work their way through the courts. So then we have the next Supreme Court races coming up that we could, once we have election reform with those Supreme Court races, we could win those as well, because we'd have the vote fraud eliminated with election reform. So there's a path here to get Wisconsin back from over the cliff. We only need to, so we should be targeting, we should find five assembly seats to target, find, and maybe to be safe, pick 10, find, we only need five Senate seats, one Senate seat, maybe pick two or three of those and really focus our efforts there to win. And then there's a path to get Wisconsin back from the liberal dungeon. The only problem then is Robin Voss needs to be primary because he's the Speaker of the Assembly, and that guy's no conservative. But once we get that's another battle that we can fight. But anyway, so that's the show for this week. Thank you guys for tuning in. Thanks for calling. No calls. Can't thank anybody for calling. Thank you guys for tuning in. Hope you guys have a great week, and we'll talk to you next week, next Sunday. Carry on, be well armed.
This is Sniper Chick Julie. You've been listening to Well Armed Radio, and I have to know, is that a gun in your pants, or did you just really enjoy the show?
Stop listening to the bombastic loudmouths on the radio and television and the internet. To hell with them.